Unless you can describe it, words are the first step to understanding. So the country began to change in very obvious ways right around the time George Floyd died, Memorial Day 2 years ago in Minneapolis. And all of a sudden, you saw large groups of people acting in what seemed to be perfect synchronicity with one another as one, and then trying to enforce a uniformity of opinion on the rest of the country. And the rest of the country, for the most part, went along with it. Nothing like this had ever happened in America, certainly not in our lifetimes. What were we watching? Something new and different, for sure. Also something self-evidently threatening to our most basic freedoms and to our human dignity. So what was it? Well, it wasn't really until December of 2021, in a broadcast of the Joe Rogan Experience, that a doctor called Robert Malone described in words what we may have been watching. Here was that clip, which instantly became famous.
What the heck happened in Germany in the 20s and 30s? You know, very intelligent, highly educated population, and they went barking mad. And how did that happen? The answer is mass formation psychosis. When you have a society that has become decoupled from each other and has free-floating anxiety and a sense that things don't make sense, we can't understand it, and then their attention gets focused by a leader or a series of events on one small point, just like hypnosis, they literally become hypnotized and can be led anywhere.
So Malone goes on to attribute that idea at the core of his description, something called mass formation, to an academic in Belgium called Matthias Desmet, who wrote a book on it, actually, called The Psychology of Authoritarianism. I want to put a quote up on the screen that gets to the nut of what he's describing, and we're quoting. Mass formation is, in essence, a kind of group hypnosis that destroys individuals' ethical self-awareness and robs them of their ability to think critically. This process is insidious in nature. Populations fall prey to it unsuspectingly. To put it in the words of Yuval Noah Harari, quote, most people wouldn't even notice the shift toward a totalitarian regime. We associate totalitarianism mainly with labor, concentration, and extermination camps, but those are merely the final bewildering stage of a long process. So those words come from, as we just said, a Belgian academic called Matthias Desmet, who we are honored to have join us on the set now to describe what all of us have been watching for the last 2 years. But Professor, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
Is it a little strange to find out that you're famous in the United States?
Yes, a little bit, yes.
So 10 years ago, I think this would have been considered a kind of esoteric academic theory, you know, relevant to your specific study, but not really relevant to the society that we live in. And all of a sudden, you've so perfectly described what the rest of us have been watching. So before we get into it, if you just tell us who you are and where you're from and how you wound up concluding this.
I'm from Belgium, as you said. I'm a professor in clinical psychology at Ghent University. I also have a master in statistics. And that's actually how In statistics, yes.
Huh.
Yeah. I did a PhD on methodological problems in academic research. I started my PhD in 2003 when it became clear that up to 85% of the academic papers is seriously flawed. That's what my PhD was all about. And then, when the corona crisis started, I immediately started to study the statistics a little bit. And I immediately got the impression that the mathematical models and the statistics that were used dramatically overrated the dangerousness of the virus. And then, in my opinion, a few months later, by the end of May 2020, this was actually proven beyond doubt. At that moment, the initial mathematical models on which the corona measures were based, the models issued by Imperial College, predicted that by the end of May 2020, in a small country such as Sweden, about 60,000 people would die if the country didn't go into lockdown. And Sweden didn't go into lockdown, and only 6,000 people died. And at that moment, for me, in the first week of the corona crisis, I published two opinion papers in which I tried to warn people that there was something dangerous out there. And I wasn't referring to the virus. The title of the first paper was "The Fear of the Virus is More Dangerous Than the Virus Itself." And strangely enough, I tried to show people in what way the statistics were wrong. But nobody really seemed to care about it. And everybody continued to buy into the narrative. And even when, by the end of May 2020, it was proven beyond the shade of a doubt that the mathematical models had been dramatically wrong, the narrative continued, and the society continued to behave as if the mathematical models had been right. And that was the moment for me when I switched my perspective. At that moment, I decided to focus on the psychological mechanisms that could explain why an entire society couldn't see anymore that the narrative they believed in was blatantly absurd in many respects. And it took me one or two months before I could, in my opinion, pinpoint it, and before I started to understand that what we were dealing with was a large-scale process of mass formation, which is like a kind of group formation, which has some very strange effects at the level of individual psychological functioning. The most important being, probably, that people who are in the grip of such a process, in one way or another, lose all capacity to take a critical distance of what the group believes in, and this can go extremely far. Like during the revolution in Iran in 1979, which was a large-scale process of mass formation in Iran, people started to believe that the portrait of the Ayatollah, whom they considered their leader, was printed on the surface of the moon. And when there was a full moon in the sky, it typically were standing in the streets showing each other where exactly you could see the portrait of the Ayatollah. That's the first strange effect at the level of individual psychological functioning of a process of mass formation. A second one?
And Iran in 1979 was not a backward, remote country. It was a very westernized, very well-educated, sophisticated country.
Of course, the level of education doesn't play any role, even not the intelligence. Even more, the higher the level of education, the easier, the more vulnerable people are for mass formation.
Okay, cool. Let me just back up a step. So you said in 2003, you begin your PhD, and your main focus was the fact, and you described it as a fact, that 85% of academic papers had serious flaws within them.
Yeah.
Now, 85% is the overwhelming majority.
Yeah,
that's academic papers are the basis of academia, so, I mean, that's a shocking. So maybe that was the first example you saw of mass formation, because how could they not fix that?
Yes, well, I published a small book about that in which I tried to show in a very tangible and concrete and simple way why most research methods impossibly can lead to valid results. And what I noticed was my examples were really clear and tangible. Everyone who wanted to see it could see that the methods could only lead to flawed results. And to my surprise, only about 5% of my colleagues wanted to open their eyes and wanted to see what I was showing, and the rest didn't want it. And that was the moment when I started to think about what could possibly explain why people became so blind. And that was the moment when I first started to be interested in mass formation. And exactly the same process repeated itself in the corona crisis. I immediately noticed, like, look, these statistics and these mathematical models can be right. I tried to show it, didn't work, and then started to think about what psychological processes could explain that. And I stumbled upon, or I tried to re-articulate my theory on mass formation in public space then.
We had the same experience.
What exactly?
In the United States, on the show, in the spring of 2020, it became clear that the original Imperial College predictions, which were the basis of our public policy here in the United States, were completely wrong, and nobody cared. In fact, they reacted with hostility if you pointed it out.
Absolutely.
Just the predicate here, the background. You pointed to 1979 as an example where this happened in another country with a large group of people. Mm. Is this a feature of history? Have we seen this a number of times?
Mass formation has existed as long as mankind exists. So there are we've had the Crusades, the witch hunts, the French Revolution, then the mass formations in the Soviet Union, the mass formations in Nazi Germany. So it has existed as long as mankind exists, but for a specific reason, the mass formations became stronger and stronger and stronger throughout the last few hundreds of years. And that's interesting because it's because in the first half of the 20th century, the masses became so strong that, led by certain leaders, they could seize control of the state apparatus. And that's how totalitarian states emerge.
Yes.
Totalitarian states, Hannah Arendt says, are always a diabolic pact between the masses and their leaders. It's a diabolic pact between the masses and their leaders. And in this way, like a completely new kind of state emerges, which is completely different from a classical dictatorship. In a classical dictatorship, there is a small group of people, a dictatorial regime, who has such an aggressive potential that people are so scared of them that they can impose unilaterally their social contract to society.
Yes.
But the totalitarian state emerges in a completely different way. In a totalitarian state, there is first a process of mass formation, which is a process through which a certain part of the population, usually about 30%, fanatically starts to believe in a certain ideology. And this phenomenon can be created artificially through indoctrination propaganda.
And just to pause, you think that number can be as low as 30%?
Yes, usually it is not higher than 30%. Yes.
That's scary.
That's scary because, yes, but there is always 60 or 65% of the people who do not really go along with the narrative, but who will never speak out, who will always choose the easy way and go along with the people, with this group of people that seems to have the loudest voice. And that's why in the end, up to 95% or even sometimes even more, go along with the totalitarian narrative, with the narrative that led to the mass formation. And there is then an additional 5% that doesn't go along with it, that tries to speak out. And that's extremely important. If you understand the mechanism of mass formation, if you really understand it, then you know what this small group should do. If it makes the wrong analysis, it will be destroyed in the end. The chance is very high that it will be destroyed. If it starts from the correct analysis, it will survive. That's why it is so extremely important to understand how this mechanism works. Because I've just mentioned that mass formation makes individuals completely blind for everything that goes against what the group believes in. But there is two other characteristics that are also extremely important. And the first one is that when people are in the grip of mass formation, they seem to lose all awareness of their individual interests. They are prepared to radically self-sacrifice. That's extremely strange. And then the third characteristic, which is the most problematic, is that people in a mass formation become radically intolerant for dissonant voices.
Yes.
And in the ultimate stage of the mass formation, they will typically start to destroy everyone who doesn't go along with the masses, and they will do so as if it is their ethical duty to do so. To refer to the revolution in Iran again, I was talking to this woman in Iran, Shoreh Feshtali. This conversation is available on the internet. And she told me how she has seen with her own eyes how in the last stage of the mass formation, a mother reported her son to the state, how this mother hung the noose around the neck of her son when he was on the scaffold. And when he was hung, she claimed to be a heroine for what she had done. That's the end stage of mass formation. And this end stage...
A mother killing her own son.
Yeah. And if you understand the mechanism, as I explain it in my book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism, it's perfectly logical why that happens. And that's why it is so extremely important. This last stage of mass formation can be prevented if the small group who doesn't go along with the mass formation makes the right choice. It has to make the right choice. And then this choice has everything to do with whether it will choose to speak out or whether it will remain silent. If it doesn't speak out, it will be destroyed because the masses will move to the last stage. So it's just quintessential for this group to continue to speak out in a honest, sincere way. And all this follows from the mechanism of mass formation. If you understand it, you'll see why the people who do not go along with it have to speak out. And that's what I explain in my book. I will have this phenomenon of mass formation, which is a kind of group formation, emerges under very specific conditions. So like the first and the most important condition is always that many people have to feel disconnected from their natural and social environment. And that was definitely the case just before the corona crisis started. The number of lonely people peaked. Up to 40% of the population worldwide reported not to have one meaningful relationship and to only connect to other people through the internet. And from this follows a second condition. If people feel disconnected from their natural and social environment, they will typically start to struggle with lack of meaning making. To give an example from the situation just before the corona crisis, 60% of the people worldwide reported that they considered their job to be a so-called bullshit job. That means a job without purpose or meaning. And in this state, if people feel socially disconnected and they feel a lack of meaning making, they will typically start to suffer from something very specific at the affective level. they will feel confronted, they will be confronted with so-called free-floating anxiety, frustration, and aggression. That means a kind of anxiety, frustration, and aggression that is not coupled to a mental representation, a kind of anxiety, frustration, and aggression in which people don't know what they feel anxious, frustrated, and aggressive for. And that state is extremely aversive. If you feel anxious and you don't know what you feel anxious for, you have the feeling that you cannot control your anxiety. If you feel frustrated and aggressive, and you don't know what you feel frustrated and aggressive for, you cannot take it out to someone, and all the frustration and aggression piles up in your psychological system and leads to a certain very aversive tension. And in this state, if the population is in this state, something very specific might happen. If under these conditions, a narrative is distributed through the mass media, indicating an object of anxiety, and at the same time, providing a strategy to deal with that object of anxiety, for instance, the lockdowns to deal with the virus, concentration camps to deal with the Jews, witch hunts to deal with the witches, and so on. If under these conditions, a narrative is distributed, disseminated through the mass media, indicating this object of anxiety and a strategy to deal with it, then there might be a huge willingness to participate in a strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, no matter how absurd this narrative is, simply because in this way, people feel that they can control their anxiety. They feel that they have something to direct their frustration and aggression on. So that's the first extremely important step. And then follows the second one, which is the really dangerous step. Because so many people participate at the same time in the strategy to deal with the object of anxiety, they feel connected again. It is as if their loneliness disappears. They feel full of solidarity. And that's the point. They have the feeling that they fight this collective, heroic battle with a virus, and they will consider everyone who doesn't go along with them as an egoist, as someone who lacks all solidarity. And that, in itself, the strange thing is, you could say, well, what's the problem? People felt lonely, and now they feel connected again. So what's the problem? But there is a problem. Because in a mass is a group that is formed not because people connect to each other. A mass is a group that is formed because each individual separately connects to the collective, meaning that the famous solidarity of the masses is never a solidarity with other individuals.
Right.
It's a solidarity with the collective. And the longer the mass formation exists, the more everyone demands that everyone sacrifices all his personal interests for the collective. And that's exactly the reason why, in the corona crisis, for instance, everyone was talking about solidarity. And at the same time, we accepted that if someone got an accident on the street, we were no longer allowed to help him. At the same time, we accepted that if our father or mother were, our parents were dying somewhere in a nursing home, that we were no longer allowed to visit them. So it was all, everyone had to sacrifice everything for the sake of the collective. So mass formation is extreme collectivism. It's extreme collectivism. It's the balance between individualism and collectivism that goes completely in a direction.
But there's no actual, but at the same time, the people who encourage it discourage the formation of individual relationships between people.
Always.
So the government in this country, the Biden administration, was encouraging children to turn in their parents to law enforcement if they said something that deviated from the corona narrative online. No. So they're breaking apart solidarity between people.
Of course.
Of course. That is always a feature of it.
The strange thing is that this happens spontaneously. In every group which has an extremely strong group identity, all the energy will be sucked away from the bonds between the individuals. For instance, in a military commando, if they have to do something dangerous, they will typically demand that there are no sexual relationships between the members of the group.
Right.
Simply because this relationship between the members, this strong relationship, could threaten the group in a dangerous situation.
Right.
These members could choose for each other instead of for the group. So that happens in every group with a very strong group identity. Spontaneously and in a mass to an extreme extent, in a mass, all solidarity, all the love between the individuals is sucked away and it's all injected in the love between the individual and the collective. And that's why in the end, even the strongest bond, the bond between a mother and her child, completely impoverishes, and even mothers report their sons to the state and get them killed if they feel that they are not loyal enough to the state. So it's a natural It's a psychological process that is very logical, but that is extremely dangerous. And that's exactly why we have to try to understand it, and we have to try to understand what we can do about it.
So what we can do about it, first of all, the hair on my arms is standing up because you've so precisely described what we've all just seen. I mean, precisely. Mm. Because it sounds like this is a feature of human nature. People are this way, always. Mm. Can you think of examples where mass formation was stopped before it became totalitarianism by a small group of people standing up and saying no?
Oh, definitely, definitely. You know, the first totalitarian systems in history were the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany in the first half of the 20th century. But there were trends towards totalitarianism at several places in the world. And in most places, they stopped.
Well, all through Europe. Yes,
they stopped. And the reason, the problem in the Soviet Union and in Nazi Germany was that the resistance at a certain moment decided to go underground and to stop speaking out in public space. That happened in 1930 in the Soviet Union and around 1935 in Nazi Germany. And within 6 months, in both countries, the destruction campaigns started. Within 6 months, the destruction campaign started. So there is a almost perfect correlation between the resistance that stops to speak out and the start of the atrocities and cruelties in a country. Simply because if you understand the mechanism, then you know, like, mass formation is a kind of hypnosis. It's identical. It's exactly the same. In a hypnotic procedure, there is someone, a hypnotist, who focuses the attention of someone else on one aspect of reality, for instance, an object that is swinging on a chain or something. And once the attention is focused on that one aspect of reality, all the rest of reality disappears. All the rest of reality, it is as if the rest of reality doesn't exist anymore. And this mechanism is extremely strong. A simple hypnotic procedure is sufficient to focus someone's attention so much on one aspect of reality that the person won't notice anymore that there is a surgeon who cuts through the skin, through the flesh, even straight through the breastbone to perform an open heart operation. That happens all the time in a university hospital in Belgium. There is a professor, Elisabeth Femonville, who uses this simple procedure to focus a patient's attention on something, and then the surgeon can do no matter what he wants, cut through the breastbone, the patient won't notice it. So that's the power of this mechanism of the focusing of attention. Exactly the same happens in a mass formation. First, people start to deal with all kinds of emotions that are no longer coupled to mental representations. And then all these emotions, all this anxiety are focused on one point, and consequently, the people don't notice anymore that they lose everything, that they lose their health, their wealth, the future of their children, and so on. That's exactly what happens in a mass formation. So once you understand that the mechanism of mass formation is a kind of hypnosis, you understand that it is a phenomenon that is always provoked by the voice of someone, the leaders of the masses who use indoctrination and propaganda to continue the mass formation, and then you also understand that if you want to disturb the mass formation, then you have to continue to speak out, that the dissonant voices have to continue to speak out. If the dissonant voices, if the people who do not go along with the masses continue to speak out, they won't succeed in waking up the masses. Sometimes someone will wake up, but usually the people will continue to be in the grip of the mass formation. But that doesn't mean that their speech has no effect. Not at all. Their speech will constantly disturb the hypnosis to a certain extent, and it will prevent the hypnosis to become so deep that the people become convinced that they have to destroy everyone who doesn't go along with them. From the 19th century onwards, scholars like Gustave Le Bon have described that the people who are not in the grip of the mass formation that their speech has exactly this effect. It doesn't wake them up, but it disturbs the mass formation, and it makes sure that it doesn't go so deep that the masses start to commit atrocities. And in this way, that's from a strategical point of view, quintessential. In this way, what will happen is the following. The masses are always self-destructive, and they will slowly exhaust themselves. They will exhaust themselves and destroy themselves before they destroyed the people who do not go along with them. So once you understand that, the first and foremost strategical principle that you have to follow is that you have to continue to speak out. And at the same time, it's also an ethical principle. As a human being...
Yes, it is an ethical principle.
It's an ethical principle. As a human being, you have the ethical duty to articulate these words that seem sincere and honest to you, no matter what the consequences are. And if you do that, we have numerous examples described by Solzhenitsyn, by Primo Levi, by Viktor Frankl. If you do that, something wonderful will happen. If you stick to your ethical principles, when the world dehumanizes, you go through a very fast process of mental evolution. A very fast process of mental evolution as a human being. You start to become stronger and stronger and stronger as a human being at the mental level, and sometimes even at the physical level. If you read Solzhenitsyn, he gives us wonderful examples of how in the gulags, most people started to act in a beast-like manner.
Yes.
But there were some, a small minority, who went in exactly the opposite direction, who in this pool of darkness chose to try to represent humanity, and who became more and more determined to stick under all conditions, no matter how difficult it was, to their ethical principles. And Solzhenitsyn gives these wonderful examples in which he describes how these people very often survived the concentration camps and became even stronger while most others died within a few weeks or a few months. Of course, it's not a guarantee, but I think that if we understand that, we understand that the process of mass formation and everything that happens now, in a certain way, has meaning and purpose. It should motivate us to understand the value of ethical principles for a human being. It should make us more determined to continue to live according to ethical principles while the rest of the world leaves them behind. So,
let me just say this. One of the most amazing conversations I've ever had, and I'm so grateful that you're, and I mean that, I'm grateful that you're here. I feel like you're speaking directly to our country. What is the difference between the people who go along, which is the majority, it sounds like, and the smaller percentage who decide, no, I'm going to say what I believe is true no matter what? What makes people to decide to take one path or the other? And can you predict it ahead of time?
No, you can't. From the 19th century onwards, from the moment psychologists have been studying the phenomenon of mass formation, it has been remarked and observed time and time again that every time a mass emerges in a society, there is a small group who doesn't go along with it. But this small group is extremely diverse and heterogeneous.
Yes.
And nobody seems to know what connects these people.
I've noticed
which characteristic these people share. But in one way or another, they all make this fundamental decision, a decision that cannot be reduced to anything else. They make this decision to choose for truth speech instead of choosing the easy way and going along with a narrative where everybody believes in, but of which everybody actually knows that it is utterly absurd and unethical. So, because the mass formation, you know, that's very interesting. The reason why people buy into the narrative that leads to mass formation is not because they think that the narrative is correct. Not at all. The reason why they buy into the narrative is because it leads to this new social bond, because it makes them feel connected again. Because loneliness is the most painful state. We don't know it, but it is like that. We don't realize it, but it is like that for a human being. And it wants to escape. It wants this new social bond. And the reason why people buy into it is because it leads to all these psychological advantages. It couples the anxiety to an object. It provides an object at which people can direct their frustration and aggression. It leads to this new connectedness. So that's the reason, this new social bond and the affective advantages is the reason why people continue to go along with the narrative, no matter how absurd it becomes. We could even say more. It's just the same like people in a football stadium all sing the same song, not because they think it's the most beautiful song in the world. No, it's because this song connects them with the other people. And And you could even say more, the more absurd the measures become, for instance, the corona measures, the more they will be applauded by this part of the population that is really in the grip of the mass formation, simply because the measures have the function of a ritual. And what is a ritual? Ritualistic behavior is always behavior that has no pragmatic meaning and that demands a sacrifice from the individual. a sacrifice through which the individual shows that the collective is more important than itself. So people, without knowing it, we live in a time in which we think the materialist view of man in the world believes that rituals have no meaning and no function, but they are essential for us. And in totalitarianism, without knowing it, people engage completely in rituals, but they don't realize it. And these rituals are rituals of death. People sacrifice, blindly sacrifice everything just to escape their profound feeling of social atomization, to escape their profound feeling of loneliness and disconnectedness. It's a kind of suicidal ritual that is committed. And that's exactly why many people expected that if the rituals became, if the corona measures became more absurd, that people would start to wake up. But that usually didn't happen.
No.
No, simply because people don't understand that unconsciously these measures have the function of a ritual. And the more absurd they are, the purer they fulfill their function
exactly.
of a ritual.
That's yeah. exactly right. The more yeah. unlikely, the more compelling.
Yeah, indeed.
So then you have to get, I mean, I think this is, again, one of the most amazing conversations I've had ever. But it does raise the question of motive. Like, why did Robespierre do that? Why did Lenin do that? Why did Hitler do that? Why did our own government, not all of whom are evil, a lot of good people, why did they do this?
Yes, we have answered the question, I think, why the population goes along with the narrative.
Yes.
Because there are all these psychological problems and they are solved by the mass formation. But the second question is, why does the elite do it?
Yes.
And I think throughout the last few hundreds of years, we have seen two things developing alongside each other. On the one hand, the population got in a state where it became more and more vulnerable for mass formation. And this simply has to do with our mechanist, rationalist view on man and the world. Something in our rationalist scientific ideology disconnects people from their social natural environment. That's what I describe in detail, really in detail, in the first five chapters of my book. I describe how it is our obsession with rational understanding, our delusional belief that the mystery of life, the essence of life, can be understood and reduced to the categories of our own rational thinking. It's that delusional belief of the human being that disconnects it from its environment more and more and more and more. And that's exactly the reason there was more and more disconnectedness in the population that led to the mass formation, which became stronger and stronger and stronger, and in the end made it so strong that totalitarian states could emerge. But at the same time, another process happened at the level of the elite. This mechanist, rationalist view on man and the world created a new elite, an elite which rationally tried to understand the psychological processes in a society and then used this rational understanding to manipulate and control the population. And that's why immediately after the French Revolution, that means after the fall of the Ancien Régime in France, yes. immediately we saw the emergence of modern indoctrination and propaganda. Napoleon was the first one who established a Bureau d'Opinion Publique, a kind of office for propaganda. And then in the beginning of the 20th century, like 100 years later, we saw already these enormous propaganda machineries of the First World War. And it became worse in the Second World War. And
yes,
now
it
it's even much, much, much more worse. Our entire public space is saturated with indoctrination propaganda constantly, simply because it's strange. If you read the works of the founding fathers of indoctrination propaganda, such as Lippmann, Trotter, Bernays, then you hear how these people think in the following way. They say, well, since modern democracy, the political leaders are not true leaders anymore. They have to be elected, meaning that they have to follow the masses. So they can never control the masses. And at that moment they decided, and you can read this literally in the works of the people I just mentioned, Lippmann, Trotter, Bernays. At that moment, these guys decided, we need constantly to manipulate the masses, or otherwise they will govern the country and not the politicians or not
yes,
us.
So right.
the elite relied more and more and more on indoctrination, propaganda, manipulation, psychological operations, brainwashing, and so on of the population. just to manipulate the masses from behind.
To subvert democracy, to end the promise of democracy,
yes, of course,
which is the
of people course,
will
of
rule.
Course, of course. That's the problem. Yeah, exactly. So why do they do it? Well, why do they do it? You know, that question should be answered, I think, in a very nuanced way. Many people think that totalitarianism is all about power and that it's all about the money. And to a certain extent, that's true. But the ultimate motivation of totalitarian leaders is always ideological in nature.
Yes.
Believe me, it's ideological. Like
Stalin actually believed in Marxism.
Of course. And he wanted to sacrifice everything, all his money and all his power, if he could just reshape society according to his Marxist ideas. That's so typical for totalitarian leaders. They want to sacrifice everything.
And they actually believe it, though.
They usually don't believe the narratives they use, but they believe the ideology blindly. So, like in this case, I think here in our situation, for me, the ideology at work is a technocratic transhumanist ideology.
Yes.
And in order to impose this ideology to society, the elite uses, the large global institution uses all kinds of narratives to convince, to try to entice the people to go along with this ideology. And these ideologies, well, these narratives are like the climate narrative or the terrorism narrative or the corona narrative. And usually the totalitarian leaders usually don't believe, they fanatically believe in their ideology. They really believe that their technocratic transhumanist ideology will create like a new paradise for the human being. But they usually don't believe the narratives they use.
Right.
They believe so blindly and fanatically in their ideology that they think it is justified to lie, cheat, and manipulate the population to convince them to accept all these ideological changes they try to impose to society. So we have to distinguish, I think, if you ask the question why they do so, in the end, I really believe they do so because they believe they have this obsessional drive to impose their ideological fiction to society. That's the root cause, I think, or the root motivation of totalitarian leaders. And I know that's not very popular. Most people prefer to believe that it's all about the money. That
no,
it's
no,
all
no,
about,
no. Because I know some of them, and I agree with you 100% that there's a sincerity at the bottom of it.
Mm.
So how far along is the West in what appears to be this move toward totalitarianism?
Well, you know, in 1951, Hannah Arendt said that we've seen the collapse of fascist totalitarianism, she said, and we will soon witness the collapse of communist totalitarianism. But she said a new totalitarianism will emerge, the ultimate totalitarianism, and that is the technocratic totalitarianism, a kind of totalitarianism which is not led by gang leaders such as Stalin and Hitler, but which is led by dull bureaucrats and technocrats. And I think
Hannah Arendt wrote that in 1951?
Yeah, in 1951, she wrote that. I mentioned it in my book. And that technocratic totalitarianism is the ultimate manifestation of the kind of ideology I just referred to, this kind of materialist, mechanist ideology, which believes that the entire universe is like a set of elementary particles, atoms and molecules that all interact with each other according to the laws of mechanics, and that can be perfectly understood in a rationalist way. If you start from such a view on man and the world, then the logical conclusion is that this universe machine and this machine-like society should be led not by democratically elected politicians, but by technocratic experts who possess the rational knowledge to make the machine run as smoothly as possible. So that's the delusional belief of a technocratic system. It's a logical consequence of our rationalist, mechanist view on man and the world. The real enemy, for me, is not the elite, it's that ideology. That ideology, that rationalist view on man and the world, that on the one hand created a new kind of population which was so vulnerable for mass formation, and on the other hand, created an elite which delusionally started to believe that it could manipulate, cheat, control, try to steer everyone in society. So that at the root cause of the problem is this mechanist ideology, which always presents itself as science, but which has nothing to do with science. If you,
but how did you have, I mean, given your job description, I mean, you're a prime candidate for believing that. Everyone in your world believes that. Why don't you believe that?
I have no idea. I had never a great talent to believe what other people believed. In one way or another, I always try to think with my own head. And I think,
what did your parents do? Like, what world were you raised in? Why did you, were you told it was important to think
for
yourself?
I will tell you something about my parents. My father didn't want me to go to university because he said, you will see, he said, the institute that pretends to represent the truth in society, you won't find much truth there, he said. So I decided to go to university against his will.
Had he gone to university?
No, but he was a very intelligent person who read a lot, really a lot, every day, in the morning and the evening, but who had like a contempt for all kinds of degrees, academic degrees. He said, like, the only reason why you should gather knowledge is because you have a passion to know, a real passion for knowledge, and not because you want to have a certain degree. And he also, in his opinion, a human being had to work with its hands and then also read and learn something in its spare time.
I think I would like him.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. So, but I went to university, and actually now that when I became a professor, I could understand them more and more. I'm happy that I went to university, but I'm also disappointed I don't think that. Maybe that holds for. Applies to society in general, but I don't think that most people are motivated by a search for truth.
How you become very public with these views, and the response to them, at least online, has been enormous, and you become famous in this country anyway. I have no idea how you're regarded in Belgium, but how do your colleagues at the university feel about what you've said?
Most react in a very defensive way. I have to say that the dean and reassured me that I had the right to express my opinion. It was clear that they were not happy with it, but I was not fired or something. But even before the corona crisis, most people at university were already angry with me. Just because I exposed the problems with research in a way that most of them didn't like. So for me, I was well prepared for the corona crisis in many respects. I was used to swim against the tide.
So everything about, or virtually everything about, our response in the West to corona has been exposed as incorrect, at best, fraudulent, at worst, right? So we know how wrong everybody was. Mm-hmm. Does that change the public's mind?
I don't think so. Maybe for a small percentage of the people, it changes their mind. But most of them, in a strange way, will continue to buy into the narrative for the reasons that I just mentioned. And the problem is that there's this phenomenon of mass formation. Mass formation, the cause of mass formation is loneliness, but mass formation itself, if you think about the mechanism that I just explained, because it sucks all this energy away from the social bond, creates even more loneliness.
Yes.
And that puts society in a condition where it is even more sensible, more vulnerable for mass formation. So if one large-scale mass formation emerges, there is a good chance that a second one will emerge, which might be even more powerful. So, and if we really want to get rid of this process of mass formation, we really will have to do something. We really have to move beyond this rationalist view on man and the world. I mean it. That's the ultimate cause. As long as we continue to believe that we can reduce the mystery of life around us to our rational understanding, we will continue to disconnect from our environment, and we will continue to be vulnerable for mass formation.
So what is the accurate position? If we're telling, our leaders are telling themselves, I can fully understand people, they're merely collections of atoms, and I can guide them toward utopia. What should be our attitude toward people? Like, what's the correct way to view?
We will have to educate them in such a way that they start to see that that they start to develop the capacity to connect to the world in a different way. I will quote René Thom, one of the most famous mathematicians of the 20th century and one of the founders of complex dynamical systems theory. He said, this part of reality that can be understood in a rational way, and he was a scientist, a top scientist, this part of reality that can be understood in a rational way is very limited. And the rest of reality, we can only understand by empathically resonating with it. And what René Thom said there,
by
empathically resonating with it. So he differentiated between two different kinds of knowledge, a rational knowledge and a kind of resonating, empathic knowledge of what happens around us. And there were so many traditions in which they were aware of the differentiation. For instance, the samurai tradition in Japan said that if you learn the martial arts, or no matter what other art, or no matter what other craft, there first is the rational, technical aspect of it. First, you learn techniques which you can understand in a rational way. But when you practice these techniques for a long time, you will start to develop something else, something that transcends all rational understanding. You will start to develop a certain feel with the art you practice. And that's and everyone who learns a craft knows this. First, you can try to understand rationally what you have to do, but slowly you start to feel what you have to do. And that's the moment where you start to resonate with what you are doing. It's this resonating knowledge which is so important, which also is this resonating knowledge which makes you feel the object that you're making in a craft, or which makes you feel the art that you're performing, or that makes you feel the object that you're studying in a scientific study, and so on. And it's as soon as you're connected in this way with the object, you start to get in touch with the eternal principles of humanity and with the eternal ethical principles of our existence as a human being. And it are these principles that can be the true cornerstone of a human living together, a really fruitful human living together. Now, since a few centuries, we believe that rational knowledge should be the cornerstone of our human living together and of our existence as a human being. That's an illusion. Rational knowledge is always extremely relative and never really touches the real. Rational knowledge circles around the real.
Are you guys listening to this? What you're saying is the truest thing. Mm. Sorry, I'm getting excited.
No. Yes. Well,
rational knowledge cannot touch the truth of human experience. I think that's what you just said.
That's what I said. Yeah.
Nobody acknowledges that. Mm. Why?
Because the illusion of complete rational understanding is so enticing for a human being. It makes him believe that he is almighty. It makes him believe that he will be able to explain everything, that he will be able to understand everything, that he will be able to manipulate everything, to control everything. It makes him believe that he will be able to live forever, to live eternally, and eternal happiness. If you read the books of someone like Yuval Noah Harari, then you see this transhumanist ideology, which is only the contemporary version of the mechanist ideology, really believes. It believes that man can become God. That's the problem.
Yes.
Through rational understanding. And that's, of course, it's extremely enticing for a human being to believe that. But at the same time, it's what destroys life, because the essence of life, and all seminal scientists have concluded exactly that. They said you can understand rationally something of reality. Think of people such as Max Planck, Niels Bohr, Heisenberg, Schroeder, Bohr, everyone, all seminal scientists concluded the same. You can understand a certain part of reality rationally, but the essence of life, I give many examples in my book, the essence of life escapes rational understanding. Meaning that, strictly logical, meaning that if you reduce life to rational understanding, you kill the essence of life.
Yes.
Inevitably. inevitably. And that's why it's so destructive. That's what we see now. We see a radical destruction of life.
Are you a man of religious faith?
I was an atheist when I was 18 years old, from my 16 to my 20 years old, because just I didn't like it to be an atheist, but I really believed, like, okay, what would the universe be if not a system of material particles, of atoms that interact according to the laws of mechanics? There is just no possibility that the universe could be something else. The universe is a material phenomenon, and it can be understood according to the laws of mechanics. It can be strictly rationally understood. And then slowly, while reading all kinds of scientific theories, I slowly started to see that the seminal scientists all started from this rationalist ideology, but that they all left it behind, one by one, that they all concluded, no, the essence of the universe is not material in nature. No, you cannot understand, it's not mechanist in nature. If you, like someone like Niels Bohr said, the Nobel Prize winning physicist who studied the elementary particles his entire life, he said, the behavior of atoms his entire life. He said, when it comes to atoms, language can only be used as poetry. And he was dead serious. He said, this behavior of elementary particles is so intrinsically irrational, transcends all rational understanding, that you need poetry or mystical discourse to resonate with it, to have a certain feeling with it. And if for me, it took me until I was 35 years old, when I dived deep into the mathematical basis of complex dynamical systems theory, before I suddenly started to see that what we call reality, what we call the facts, simply are not rational. They are not rational. Complex dynamical system theory, and it's a paradox, it's paradoxical, but it's what complex dynamical systems theory shows. This theory shows, in a strictly rational way, that the essence of life is irrational. Literally, that all complex dynamical phenomena in nature, and that's most phenomena in nature, behave like an irrational number in mathematics. They are unpredictable. For instance, a complex dynamical system such as convection patterns and turbulence in fluid or gas, can be described by a mathematical formula, by the Navier-Stokes equations. But even with these equations in your hand, you cannot predict 1 second in advance how this convection pattern will behave. So this completely breaks the illusion that we would ever be able to really predict life. We will never be able. Our rational understanding stumbles upon an absolute limit, and it's beyond that limit that the essence of life situates. It's the mystery of life, transcends rational understanding. And if you continue to build that wall around you of logical reasoning, because logical reasoning is really building a wall around you, you connect the one logical idea to the other. And in this way, you isolate yourself from your environment. But as soon as you start to become humble enough, and as soon as you start to become aware of the fact that your rational understanding is limited, it is as if literally all these logical building blocks slide away from each other a little bit, and as if the eternal music of life can go through the holes of the wall and can touch the strings of your body and your soul. And it is at that moment that you can start to resonate with the mystery of life around you, with the eternal spirit of life. And it is exactly at that moment, I experienced that in my own life, that you can start to tolerate the idea of death and dying. And that's the most elementary disease of our society, because we believe, we are so obsessed by rational understanding, we don't know anymore what to do with the idea of death, dying, suffering.
Yes, that's right. It's exactly right. And we deny it. We pretend it's not real. Mm. And that gives rise to great anxiety, don't you think?
Of course. It leads to a certain anxiety. It leads to an incapacity to accept that life is risky sometimes, that we might lose something. It leads to, in a strange way, at the same time, people reduce this life to something complete, or the rationalist ideology reduces this life to something completely meaningless, to a biochemical process in our brain or to a biochemical process in our body. And at the same time, we cling to this life as if it is the only thing that counts. So that's a paradox. That's
yes,
a paradox,
it is.
Of course.
It is.
Yes, it is a paradox.
So where did it lead you from atheist to what?
At least it led me to someone who understands that we should be humble enough to know that we will never, that our rational understanding is important, but that it is only the first stage and that it should never be the goal in our lives. There is something that transcends rational understanding that is much more important. And I also believe that it made me, I will quote Max Planck, also a Nobel Prize winning physicist. He said, "I've spent my entire life in the laboratory investigating elementary particles, and I came to the conclusion that our rational understanding is extremely limited, and that in the end, the only thing that counts is something that transcends rational understanding. That in the end, it's a contact with something that we can only resonate with." He said it in a very literal way, and he said that something that transcends all rational understanding. "I will be clear," he said, "for me is a personal God." He said, "a personal God." So that, he said, "in my opinion, in my experience, science ultimately arrives where religion once started, in a contact with something that transcends all rational understanding." And that something, he said, "that transcends all rational understanding, for me, is a personal God." That was how Max Planck put it. It is a wonderful book. You should read it. It's so wonderful. It's a wonderful book in which he shows, or in which he describes an experience that most seminal scientists have experienced. Namely, that if you follow reason, and if you really push rational understanding to the limit, you suddenly arrive at the limit, and it's there that the real journey of life starts.
Yes. Do you have hope for the West that we can stop what seems inexorable, unstoppable?
Of course. Yes. I'm realistic. Realistic in the short term. I think that the years to come will be difficult years, very difficult years.
How?
I think that this technocratic system and this rationalist ideology will impose itself in a radical way to our society. Everyone who doesn't want to go along with it will be excommunicated, I think. But if this group makes the right choice, and the most important thing is definitely that it should choose to continue to speak out, I mean it, it should choose to we should continue to speak out no matter how difficult it become, it will survive, and it will, after a while, it will be able to deliver the real ethical principles that have the potential to organize a society in which human beings can live a life worthy of a human being. I think that will be, that's what awaiting us, I think.
How deep is your commitment to saying what you believe is true? I mean, is there any circumstance where you would stop speaking?
I don't think so.
Period.
You know, yes, I don't think so. What I experienced throughout the last 2 years showed me something that for me is the most important thing in life. I lost some things. I was, to a certain extent, kicked out of some academic commissions and so on because people didn't want to be in the same academic group as me anymore. But the more I continue to speak out, and I always try to do so in a calm and quiet way, I think that's important.
Yes.
We should try to speak out in a sincere and honest way, not because we are convinced that we are the only ones who know the truth or something. No, just because we want to live up to this ethical duty of articulating the words that, to the best of your own understanding, are true words, sincere words, and honest words. And while I try to do so time and time again throughout the last 2 years, or 2.5 years, I started to feel that like a soft, warm power became stronger and stronger in myself.
Yes.
And I started to feel that we indeed might lose a lot, but we shouldn't care too much about that. We should make sure that we don't lose the only thing, That is really important for a human being. And it is exactly this feel with the eternal principles of life, with the eternal, you can call it no matter what you want, with what transcends all rational understanding, with truth. The truth. That's the only thing that we should really care of and make sure that we don't lose it. All the rest is of secondary importance, I think.
Really a remarkable conversation, and I want to thank you for coming all this way to have it with us. And I hope this is seen by, you know, as many people as can possibly see it.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, thank you. That's heartfelt.
For listening to me.
Remarkable. Matthias de Smet, an amazing man. Tucker Carlson today is the name of the show. 3 episodes a week on Fox Nation. Of course, we'll come back and see you every weeknight at 8 p.m. on the Fox News channel. Good evening and welcome to a special edition, an analytical edition of Tucker Carlson Tonight. So everybody's focused on this fall's midterms for good reason, but maybe bigger elections have already happened, more meaningful elections. These were local races that you probably haven't heard about because nobody pays attention. Here's what they were. Last week, the Republican Party flipped 5 majority-left school districts in big counties in Florida. That would be Miami-Dade, Sarasota, Duval, Martin, Clay counties. Miami-Dade alone is one of the biggest school districts in the entire country. It's got more than 300,000 students in it. So this change has major implications for the education and the future of millions of young people. And it's not just happening in Florida. A Texas school board that flipped the Republican Party earlier this year is already working to change things. They just voted to ban race hatred and gender cult ideology in schools. So there may be a lesson here. Let's say you're a Republican running for Congress in November. You might be wondering, how did these Republicans win at the local level? It wasn't just because it's a red wave year, because actually